to NACE Clinical Highlights. I'm Dr. Greg Sherman, Chief Medical Officer for NACE. Joining me today for a discussion on diabetes and cardiovascular disease is Dr. Mark Stoller. Mark is an Associate Professor of Clinical Medicine in the Division of Medicine at Northwestern University Medical School and is a highly regarded speaker in the area of diabetes and cardiovascular disease. Mark is really a true thought leader in this area, and I'm excited to spend a few minutes with him today to discuss how to incorporate the evolving database of trials that's coming out to do a better job caring for our patients with diabetes and cardiovascular disease. Mark, I'm glad you could join me today. As you well know, primary care clinicians are on the front line of diabetes management, yet with all the data that's coming out, staying on top of evidence-based decisions can be really daunting for many. What I was hoping to do as we have our discussion today is really get a better understanding of some of the mechanisms that are predisposing patients with diabetes to all these cardiovascular complications, which is at the heart of the studies that are coming out. So maybe you could discuss what it is that predisposes patients with diabetes to cardiovascular disease.
Well, Greg, it's actually insulin resistance that's the background that cardiovascular complications come out of. So insulin resistance drives most of the cardiovascular complications we see in clinical practice. In fact, 75% of all patients with cardiovascular disease are insulin resistant. So diabetes is an insulin resistant patient who has the additional risk factor of hyperglycemia and the dysmetabolic state that goes along with hyperglycemia. So the diabetic is a high risk patient because of their insulin resistance. And then adding in hyperglycemia further predisposes them to cardiovascular complications.
So do you think that they're equal contributors, the insulin resistance and hyperglycemia, or is it hyperinsulinemia that's a contributing factor?
Actually, hyperinsulinemia was a fashionable culprit back in the day as a potential driver of cardiovascular complications. We now know that insulin itself does not accelerate cardiovascular risk. It's simply the insulin-resistant milieu. Free fatty acid metabolism is quite disrupted in insulin resistance, and that leads to systemic inflammation both in the fat cell and the artery, which then drives the atherosclerosis that we see. So it's an important principle to remember, because as we treat diabetes and with the newer drugs that we're using, we've forgotten about treating insulin resistance with our medications. So it's an important concept to always remember: insulin resistance is behind the cardiovascular disease that we're seeing.
Great. So some of the other studies that are coming out are really looking at heart failure, and I wonder if you can comment whether or not the issues of diabetes with heart failure is affected by the same causal factors as cardiovascular disease, or is there a different mechanism driving that process?
So the heart failure is a different animal. You know, we used to think, okay, diabetics had more heart failure because they had more vascular disease and therefore they had systolic dysfunction simply on that basis. In the old days, there was something called cardiovascular syndrome X seen in diabetics, where there was a sort of a fibrotic change that we saw. We now know that heart failure is the one cardiovascular syndrome that is driven by hyperglycemia. The worse the control, the more likely heart failure is to occur. And we now know it's more due to changes in cardiac myocyte metabolism in diabetes than the actual vascular disease we see in the insulin resistant patient. So not only do they have that insulin resistant milieu, which accelerates risk, but now you bring in the abnormal cardiac metabolism based on hyperglycemia, and you really have a patient population that's much more at risk for the development of heart failure, not just systolic, but in the diabetic patient, heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, or the old diastolic dysfunction.
And I imagine that we're going to see more and more cases with the epidemic of obesity that's prevailing across the country and globally, that we're going to see more and more cases of patients with diabetes that develop heart failure complications as well as cardiovascular disease.
This is just opinion-driven, Greg, rather than absolute hard and fast data, but I think that in clinical practice, we're going to see less and less vascular disease as we do a better and better job preventing or addressing with our therapies up front, and more congestive heart failure down the line, especially since diabetes is occurring in a younger and younger patient population.
I want to let our listeners know that you can access an enduring CME activity on diabetes and cardiovascular disease at our website, naceonline.com, and learn more about what Mark and I are discussing today. You can access this and many other programs we have developed on other topics as well. You can register for one or more of the live, regional, and virtual conferences we produce every year. If you're on Facebook, please like us and we will be able to share more educational content and more information with you. Mark, as we think about the studies that are coming out, there's a tremendous focus on the relationship between renal and cardiovascular disease. And I'd like to really talk about that a little bit to understand more about that relationship, and more specifically, the SGLT2 class of drugs that seems to have a more significant impact on these two issues. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on those things.
So the kidney and the heart have a very dysfunctional relationship. And what we see is a decline in renal function in diabetes, both on the basis of hyperglycemia, but also on the basis of vascular disease. So sort of the vascular disease helps worsen renal function. As renal function declines, blood pressure goes up, sodium retention accrues, and you begin to then increase CVD based on renal dysfunction. And one of the most frustrating aspects for clinicians is as you move more towards end-stage renal disease, the risk of heart failure due to volume-driven issues goes up. So the two, as you get later and later in disease, really make treatment of either one successfully very difficult. And that's why being more proactive in prevention of the renal dysfunction really will help address CV risk long-term as well. As far as how the SGLT2s impact cardiorenal disease, you have to remember that the favorable outcomes were a total surprise. No one expected the SGLT2 class to have dramatic impact on CV outcomes. It was really meant to be a safety or non-inferiority trial, and lo and behold, we saw very unexpected cardiovascular outcomes. With that data, and with the data in those studies also showing a decrease in macroalbuminuria with the SGLT2s, what's now happened is that further studies have been done looking at, do SGLT2s prevent progression to renal failure? And I think with some of the most recent studies, it's clear that this class of drugs improves renal function long term. It doesn't restore, but it prevents the decline in GFR and progression by a significant percentage. And so use of this class may help sort of unwind that dysfunctional relationship between the kidney and the heart by being proactive in both settings.
So what about the GLP-1 class of drugs? Does that work by the same mechanism, or is that completely different?
It's different. Whether or not it's additive remains to be seen. You know, we have all these different drugs that show positive effects, but when you begin to superimpose them on each other, do you still see the same magnitude of effect? We don't know. The SGLT2 class probably has its renal protective effect by altering pressure across the glomerulus. There are other mechanisms by which it may also have beneficial effect, but it seems to be a pressure-related phenomenon. The GLP-1s are probably going to have a bigger impact on endothelial function and the vascular impact on the kidney. And so it's a different mechanism. And again, whether it's additive to a significant degree or independent of each other remains to be seen. But both drugs have been shown to have some favorable impact on the kidney. You could throw in pioglitazone. We've known for a long time that pioglitazone reduces microalbuminuria, and the mechanism for that is through impact, favorable impact on the endothelium. So we have a lot of strategies available to us to both prevent renal dysfunction, but also to address progression in the patient who has established renal dysfunction.
I think that's great, and certainly it makes it all that much more challenging for our primary care colleagues out there to understand how to utilize all this data that's coming out. So I would love to hear your perspective on how to take the massive amounts of data that's coming out regarding the cardiovascular and renal outcomes and sort of give some guidance to our colleagues on how to utilize that in practice. Where should they think of, you know, classes of drugs for which type of patients? And the guidelines are changing as well. So maybe you could distill some of that for our colleagues.
Well, you know, I think the part of the problem with the guidelines changing is that they may be a little too enthusiastic on the cardiovascular side of things, and ignore the fact that we're still treating diabetes. Our goal is to get patients to target and keep them there by conserving beta cell function. So your primary thing is, how can I do my best job lowering blood glucose and keeping the beta cell healthy? At that point, you then look at your medications and go, well, I have favorable effects from SGLT2s, I have favorable effects from GLP-1s, I have favorable effects from pioglitazone. Which one is going to be most appropriate in a given patient? Certainly, any patient who's had volume issues or heart failure issues or hypertensive, there is some benefit in moving towards an SGLT2 in those patients. In other patients, the GLP-1s are very potent in helping restore beta cell function, not restore to normal, but improving beta cell function. And obviously, with some variability within the class, there is CV benefit and potentially some renal benefit as well. And so in the appropriate diabetic patient, that would be a choice. And then many patients can't afford the more expensive SGLT2s or GLP-1s. And mechanistically, pioglitazone works through many of the same pathways as the GLP-1. And on a cardiovascular outcome and stroke basis, the data is very much equivalent. And so for patients where cost is an issue, pioglitazone remains a very favorable drug in the patient without congestive heart failure to address CV risk.
So if we have a patient with diabetes that has a history of volume overload, congestive heart failure, and is on metformin therapy, then potentially an SGLT2 might be a good second-line drug to go to, given it's the data that we've seen on the class?
If the patient's GFR allows for effective use of SGLT2s. Remember, when the GFR goes below 45, then the glycemic efficacy of those drugs are reduced, and we don't have enough data to say, oh, let's use these drugs in diabetes even if they don't lower blood glucose. So that's the caveat, is you have to have enough GFR for them to effectively lower blood glucose in a diabetic patient to justify their use. But in the patient with GFR above 45, no issues.
That sounds great. And in a patient without evidence of heart failure but established cardiovascular disease, does the data suggest a GLP-1 RA might be a better second-line drug, or we can't make that statement yet?
You know, again, these are guidelines and not 100% evidence-based as to what's best. We can only do evidence-based into what an individual trial shows. If you ask me what's the best combination of diabetes therapies to both lower blood glucose, help the beta cell, and address cardiovascular risk, it would be pioglitazone and a GLP-1 in the patient you described.
Great. Mark, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me and share your expertise on caring for our patients with diabetes and cardiovascular disease. I think this has been really helpful for our colleagues to understand some of the underlying pathophysiology of the cardiovascular disease and renal disease, as well as understanding how to utilize some of this data in practice. And hopefully it'll help us do a better job caring for our patients with diabetes. If you're interested in learning more about managing diabetes, go to our website at naceonline.com and register for our enduring activities on diabetes or any other programs we have developed. Please like us on Facebook at NACEME to be part of our online social media community and get access to other content and programs we share. I want to thank you, our audience, for joining us for this podcast. I hope you have learned something new you can bring back to your practice. We look forward to having you join us at other upcoming podcasts in the near future. Mark, I just want to go back. Before I ended it, I want to ask you for some final thoughts.
Sure, hang on a second, because I'll have to close the door and get quiet. So hold on a second. Go ahead.
Mark, any final thoughts that you'd like to share with our colleagues on how to do a better job caring for their patients with diabetes?
You know, Greg, I think it's an exciting time in diabetes because we can have favorable outcomes on many fronts with our patients using our medications at our disposal. But again, our goal as primary care physicians and endocrinologists is to get the diabetes treated effectively first, but use strategies that may have additional CV benefit as well. I think one of the challenges that all of us face is, do we view these as class effects within the class, or individual drug effects, because each study design that a clinician may read has varying degrees of patients where they're doing primary prevention, meaning patients at risk but don't have disease, versus patients with established disease. And you'll see varying outcomes, especially within the GLP-1 class, in terms of benefit or non-demonstrated benefit. I think the bottom line is GLP-1s are very effective for beta cell and overall modest but statistically significant impact on CVD. The SGLT2 class is intriguing because not only is there potential for CV benefit through a different mechanism, but the renal benefit is most attractive as well. And I think as we try and prevent the inevitable decline in renal function in most of our diabetic patients, this class really gives us a new opportunity to do an even better job than we're currently doing in protecting the kidney.
I think that's great. All right, that's all I had. I was just thinking that might be a good piece before I summarize and close.
Okay. Perfect.
Do you want to do a close now? Or?
Well, I sort of record a little close. Maybe it's just close and have him say things.
Shift it around. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just going to do that close one more time.
Great.
Mark, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me and share your expertise on caring for our patients with diabetes and cardiovascular disease. I think this has been really great for our audience to incorporate some of the evolving data into doing a better job of caring for our patients and will truly make a difference in their lives. So thanks so much.
My pleasure, Greg.
That's all for the NACE Clinical Highlight Show for today. Thanks so much for joining us.